Welcome back to the Best Worst Thing podcast. I'm your host, Joshua Lewa. My next guest is the president and CEO of Boys Help Girls Hope, an international nonprofit dedicated to educating, mentoring, and preparing youth for higher education and a life of being men and women for others. She has served this organization since 2005, holding previous roles as vice president of international and director of Latin American operations. With a steady career in the nonprofit sector, her leadership has impacted countless young lives all across the world who are aspiring and deserving to go to college. She received her BA in political science from Carleton College and her MBA from Stanford University. And you can learn more about Boys Help Girls Hope at boyshelpgirlshope.org. Please welcome Kristen Ospi de Barillas. How are you?
Good. Thanks, Josh. It's great to connect with you. Appreciate the time to do this.
Well, I appreciate you doing this from overseas, or at least from out of the country. And I mean, this is the great thing about, you know, even though we have this difficulty with the pandemic, it's nice that we're able to use this. I know I've connected with Boys Help Girls Hope several times since the pandemic via Zoom and other tools. And so it's good that we can do this.
Absolutely.
So as we get started, I kind of give that set up, and people kind of always comment about how I snoop and find out so much information about them. I was able to find this information, but I'd love just to know a little bit more if you can tell the listeners about your role at Boys Help Girls Hope.
Yeah, thank you. So as you said, I've been with the organization since 2005 and in this current role since January of 2017. And we support 1,200 young people who are really, each one has a different story, different background, different personality. But what they have in common is that they are curious, motivated, great kids with a real spark and an interest in having a bright future and changing the lives of really their families and their communities. All of them come to our program because they're in some sort of a difficult situation, or where they are really won't allow them to meet their dreams and goals. And so they need a different kind of support structure to fulfill kind of their purpose in life. And we have two types of programming. So we have residential programming where young people are really with us full time in our homes and living in this very structured, supportive, loving family kind of environment. And then we have academy programs for young people who can stay at home with their families, but need the extra support after school, weekends, summers, to think about their future, prepare for college, careers, life skills. And with all of these young people, we typically work with them from sixth, seventh grade, all the way through college and into their careers. So it's kind of like a big family with its ups and downs along the way of life, but we stick with people for a long time. And we're in 16 different affiliate cities, 14 in the U.S., and then Monterrey, Mexico, and Guatemala City. And each affiliate city has its own team, its own board, obviously the scholars who are a part of the program and their families. And I think the best analogy for my job is really to be kind of a symphony conductor. I know that that analogy is used a lot, but really, it's about finding in each of these cities and across the network the ideas that are resonating, how we build a vision for the future together moving forward, connecting the dots of, you know, there's a best practice in Detroit. How do we share that with other cities? Or there might be a need in one city that other cities can help fill. And kind of taking this community of people who have this passion and mission around young people and moving us all together and forward in a unified way. It's an awesome job. I get to do work that I love every day.
I love the way you framed that idea of connecting the dots around all the affiliates all around the world. And such a dynamic organization. I should disclose to the listeners that I worked for Boys Help Girls Hope for a short while as a program director. And it was some of the best, compassionate work that I've done, some of the best mission work I've done in my career in helping these young people. In fact, a couple of them ended up working, going to school at the university I work for now. And one of them is actually getting ready to complete her master's degree in our program. And so I've seen what this program can do. And it's great that we get a platform for people around the country and even around the world to learn more about it. I'm curious about your approach to leadership because, you know, it's such a complex organization. As you mentioned, all the affiliates and is you're trying to, you know, we know every city is unique. We know every affiliate has unique needs. And then we know that every student is unique and individual has their unique needs. And so you're at this really high level, this 30,000 foot view of everything. And I'm curious about how do you approach leadership with such a complex organization, which with such important needs?
Well, I think my job really comes down to relationships and being in constant dialogue with people on my team who are doing different roles with the network, but also talking a lot with different scholars, with collegians. I love talking with our alumni. We have incredible alumni who are now in all kinds of different careers and their parents and their spouses and, you know, doing really interesting things. And then talking with team members and board members across the network. And I do a lot of listening. Like, what is happening from your vantage point? What's working? What's not working? What ideas do you have? And then trying to take all that and pull it together into a unified plan of how we're going to move forward. We've had to build a lot of structure and systems to do the work we're doing. But what really makes all of that happen is the relationships and trust. If we don't have the human piece, none of the systems we have, like Salesforce for data management, none of that really matters if the people piece isn't in really good shape.
Yeah, it's. I think that's a real critical piece that I think anybody who aspires to have some sort of senior level executive position should listen to. It doesn't sound like a traditional mindset of what people think leadership is, which is you come in and you tell people what you want, you have a vision, and you even tell them how to do it. It's connected to your relationships and the trust that you're building. And this stands out to me is this idea of doing a lot more listening and figuring out how to apply that to the structures that you need to have in place. They're all very helpful hints for any aspiring leaders. I'm curious about how you got to this work. I know you did some fellowships prior to another nonprofit and then getting into Boys Hope Girls Hope. So what pulled you into this path? What was your career path that helped you get to running this organization?
Well, I'll tell you before I answer that head on, when I talk to young people, I always tell them, you've got to research what you want to do. You've got to try different things, you know, do your personality test, do all of that work, but pay a lot of attention to what happens along the way. And sometimes it's the person who you least expect to make some comment or ask some question that really pivots the next direction in your life. And so I've tried very hard to kind of have some sort of a vision and a plan, but also let life unfold and take some risks along the way with things that aren't quite so predictable or maybe weren't in the plan I had in mind. So just going to kind of college years, I went to Carleton College, as you mentioned, in Northfield, Minnesota, and I was very interested in political movements and diversity and became really interested in the civil rights movement. I took a lot of classes just in those areas. And I had an opportunity the summer before my sophomore and junior year of college to do a fellowship at the Martin Luther King Papers at Stanford. So I was working with incredible professors and researchers and historians and met some amazing people and looking at, you know, I would transcribe Dr. King's letters to Ralph Abernathy and to other people and really paying attention to everything that went into the civil rights movement, which is not always the headlines, but how did people organize? How did they relate? How did they deal with issues as they came up? And during that summer, I loved it, but I realized I'm not a researcher type. Like, I don't want to be dealing with papers and transcribing and thinking about the past. I'm really interested in what's happening now. And I started asking the different people there who were, you know, historians and coming through, like, where do you think the civil rights movement is present in the Bay Area today? And a number of people said, you've got to go check out Glide Memorial Church in San Francisco. And Reverend Cecil Williams marched with King. He's been doing this work since the civil rights movement. And he and his wife, Janice Mirakatani, had built an organization which is thriving today, feeding the homeless, helping people who are coming out of years of incarceration, giving them their first jobs, creating housing opportunities. And I went there and just that summer that I was at the King Papers and just felt like, yes, this is where I need to be. And it still is a very kind of crazy, dynamic, chaotic mix of people from all walks of life. From, you know, I met Maya Angelou multiple times and Robin Williams and Bono from U2, but also people with huge mental health challenges and people coming out, you know, veterans who are homeless and people who'd been in jail for 40 years coming out to a world they didn't know. So I loved the mix. I loved the mix of people. And I decided to go the next summer and intern there. And I got a Ford Foundation research grant to do this research at GLIDE the following summer. This is now the summer before my senior year of college. And I had this whole thing I'd worked out with my professors at Carleton about data and questions and research. And the first week, one of the guys who had recently come out of prison and was working with the food program and security for the food program, you know, said to me, hey, if you want to understand how this place really works and answer all of your questions, go work in the stock room with the 17 guys who just came out of prison helping to feed the homeless this summer. You're not going to learn anything by asking the questions on your clipboard. And so I wrote a letter to the Ford Foundation and said, you know, this is a different plan. This isn't what I was going to do. But, you know, I'd really like to work in the stock room and just kind of learn from these people and hear their stories and better understand what they're doing. And it was an incredible summer. I had really good conversations. People would ask me, these African-American men would say, you know, why do white women cross the street when we're coming down the street? Why are they scared of us? What's behind that? You know, why would you, a young woman from the suburbs, drive in every day to the Tenderloin of San Francisco to work with us? Like, what is it that draws you here? So I was just very moved by the conversations, by the experiences. And ended up going back to GLIDE after college graduation and working there for 5 years with the founders, and just incredible life experience. Fast forward, in that time, I met my now husband, Benito, who grew up in an orphanage in Guatemala, and he was in the U.S. on a Fulbright. He really told me about Guatemala and said, you care about people and making a difference. You should really come down and do some work there. So after spending 5 life-changing years at GLIDE, I went to Stanford Business School to get my MBA, knowing I wanted to continue a nonprofit, but wanted that kind of administrative experience around running a nonprofit. And after that, we moved to Guatemala in 2005. And that's when I started with Boys Hope, Girls Hope.
That's an amazing journey. It's really interesting. You brought up earlier this idea of paying attention to things around you, right? And having the vision, but, you know, being open to what unfolds in life. And so 2 big lessons, you know, one of them, of course, is listening to someone who's recently, you know, out of prison, who gives you the biggest education that you needed, right? Beyond the BA at Carleton, which is a wonderful campus. And of course, Stanford, which is another wonderful campus, is this idea of like, go to the people. Why don't you go listen to the people and really find out what's going on? And that really opened up something really important for you. And then, meeting Benito, which of course is life changing in many ways, but in one particular way of being able to, meet this person who, he's the example of Boys Hope, Girls Hope, right? He's raised in an orphanage and then ends up at a Fulbright. And we have so many students who have had, a difficult start, maybe a wide range of challenges, but Boys Hope, Girls Hope, who are able to do such tremendous things through education. And so it's amazing how this is all connected. At least that's how I'm reading this.
No, I think that's right. I mean, every step of the way, when especially in my, you know, teens and 20s and 30s, you don't quite see how this is all connected. But it's funny now, I'm 44 years old and kind of looking back at this, like, oh, there's a real thread that was consistent throughout my life. And I would say I've always been drawn to people who, despite the odds, despite the challenges, and my husband had many as a child, you know, have this sense inside, I can be more. I want more for my life. People are not going to tell me I can't do things. I'm going to move forward. And honestly, that was the same as the man coming out of prison who I worked with. Well, life has turned out a certain way to date, but I've got a whole life in front of me and I'm going to make this happen. And those are the people who I've always wanted to be around, be a part of that journey. Much more interesting to me than people who kind of have it all and may or may not do anything with that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think those are very admirable traits. This idea of just resilient and persistent people is a very admirable trait. So let's talk about your background. I understand your husband's from Guatemala, but can you tell us a little bit more about kind of where you're from and your upbringing?
So I was born in Annandale, Virginia, and my dad was an attorney. He had been in the Marine Corps and fought in Vietnam. And my mom was a stay-at-home mom and a teacher. And at the time that my mom was pregnant with me, my parents had a family that were refugees from Vietnam, the two parents and four kids, living with our family, my two older brothers and my parents. And I reference that because I think I was born into a household that was always, my parents were always doing something. They were always kind of just alive and making things happen. And so I grew up for 7 years in Virginia. And then my parents said to us one day, you know, we are really passionate about helping to end wars in the world. After my dad's experience in Vietnam, my grandfather had been a Marine as well. My dad said, we've got to do better. People suffer so much when we go to war, and there's so much tension between the U.S. and Russia. And they had been involved in this kind of movement to try and end the arms race and wars. And the organization they were working with was headquartered in Palo Alto, California. So my parents said, you know what? We're selling the house. Dad doesn't have a job yet. We're going to drive across country. We'll figure out where we're going to live and how we're going to make money, but we're passionate about this work. And so we moved to Palo Alto, my two brothers and I and my parents, and really grew up there. My mom ended up going back to work for Edward Jones as a financial representative and then became a general partner. And my dad continued his legal work. And my parents really gave us kind of this, or gave me this view that they had a lot of passions, they lived very fully, but also that life had its chapters. My mom in particular, you know, was a stay-at-home mom and then a teacher and then kind of an activist and then went into the business world, and that gave her a lot of joy working with people. So very supportive family that I grew up with.
That's so again, just paying attention to some of these themes here, you know, with your parents. I mean, it's clear that their passion and their value for service really moved them. In fact, literally across the country, and now you see yourself in the same position of your upbringing in Virginia, California, and then now moving across the globe, you know, across the world. It's just amazing. I do think that people are paying attention, and we are infecting people with both positive and negative things all the time. And in your case, your parents sound like some amazing people. I kind of had an interesting look on my face, I guess, when you mentioned your dad was in the Vietnam War and then decided that they wanted to bring families who were refugees from Vietnam into the household. Because, you know, the stereotype you have in your mind is, you know, people who survived that war, when they came back to the United States, they weren't really treated really well. The soldiers, the military men and women, but the men in particular, weren't treated really well. And for your dad to really see the compassion of what war does to other communities, and in fact, helping people from those communities and just driving a big part of life. That's a pretty interesting, an interesting take.
Yeah, you know, my dad has grappled with that his whole life. He's in his late 70s now, and I'm very close to both of my parents, but he worked with veterans throughout his life, just did different sessions where he would meet with other veterans and people who had been, you know, had really struggled and had deep, deep, deep trauma and depression coming out of war. And then he stayed connected. My parents are still very close with this family from Vietnam who had lived with us. And I think my dad is very astute on history and politics, but they always just paid a lot of attention to the human side of things and realizing that whatever color you are, whatever country you're in, whatever side of any issue you're on, at the end of the day, we're all human beings, right? We all have our good days, our bad days, our worried days. I think my parents just kind of taught me to stay tuned into people that way.
Well, that's amazing. Well, it's no wonder you've become the person that you are, and you've taken that and you've built on it even more so, which is really impressive. So we're going to take a little bit of a break here, and then we're going to get into the big question. All right. As you know, I just want to say I've appreciated learning a lot more about you. Just really gives me a lot of context for who you are and your leadership of Boys Hope, Girls Hope. I don't typically do this as part of the podcast, but I do want to really put a call out there. First of all, we have listeners in Vietnam.
Wow.
So I just want you to know that, because I get to track the statistics. And so I think that's one interesting piece. The second piece is, for those of you who are interested in supporting Boys Hope, Girls Hope, we'll get your contact information at the end of the podcast, Kristen. So, or at least the organization's information, because this is a wonderful organization doing incredible work. I've seen you know, I used to think, you all have heard my story on the podcast if you listen. And I used to think that my story was challenging and tough with my parents and some of the challenges I went through as a youth. And then I met these kids at Boys Hope, Girls Hope, who are striving to go to college. And I heard their stories, and I actually experienced their stories. Students, young people losing their parents to addiction or incarceration or just poverty challenges in general. And I got to tell you, even though I couldn't cry in front of my team when I ran my team, when I worked for Boys Hope, Girls Hope, it was really both heartbreaking and fulfilling and empowering, because if I could see these young people do it, then I knew that, you know, I could keep pushing through a lot of things that I went through. And so it's just a powerful organization that helps young people who are really motivated. So I know we'll get to that at the end. And so please make sure you listen to the end so you can get that contact information. But at this point, I really want to move towards the big question. So at this point, we ask our guests to tell their best worst thing. And so this is a time that was personal or professional where you had some sort of a setback or difficulty. And so it's, what did you learn from it? What happened? How did you kind of work through it, or how are you working through it? And what did you learn from it? So with that being said, Kristen, what is your best worst thing?
Thanks, Josh. I will say I love this question. And whenever we have people come speak to the young people at Boys Hope, Girls Hope, I like to ask this question because everybody has their setbacks in life. So when I was 6 years old, my parents thought I had the flu. I got very sick. I lost 15 pounds, and I was a little 6 year old. So I suddenly shrunk a lot, almost went into a coma and was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. And so I remember very clearly at Georgetown Hospital being told, you know, your body doesn't make any insulin. You're going to need to start taking shots. And at the time, testing your blood sugar with urine tests before they had blood tests. It was a pretty dramatic moment as a six-year-old to realize my life was going to look very different from then on. And one of the great things about it is at Georgetown, they did a lot of educating me rather than telling my parents. I know on the side they were coaching my parents, but rather than gearing it to my parents, they really geared it to me. You need to understand your body. You need to know what's going on with what you eat and with insulin and exercise and stress. So it was a very empowering approach. As I got a little bit older, I started reading more about diabetes. And at the time, most people who'd had type 1 diabetes for a long time lost their eyesight. Many had their feet amputated, kidney problems. And so it was a pretty morbid and depressing outlook for this disease I had. Fortunately, I've been able to take very good care of it, and the technology and medical support has come a long way. And so I'm happy to say I'm so healthy at this point. But I think one of the lessons, there are a few for me in that. One is, I started at age 6, 7, 8 to have a real sense of mortality and urgency. You know, a lot of people talk about later in life saying they realize life's going to end at some point and all the things they wanted to do. And I really grew up with kind of this sense of purpose. Like, I don't know how long I'm going to be here. I don't know if I'm going to be blind when I'm 30. I don't know if I'm ever going to be able to have children. And so I better do the things I want to do now. And I'm going to take really good care of myself because I hope to live a long life, but nothing's guaranteed. And I think even though that was sort of painful and traumatic as a kid, and even to this day it can be, there was a real gift in that, in having this sense that every day is valuable and make the most of it and figure out what you want to do with it, because it's not going to be endless. I also had experiences as a kid where I got very, very sick with diabetes as it happens. My blood sugar went extremely low. At one point, I had gone to a day camp and they offered, who wants to go on this 15-mile hike? You could opt in or opt out. And I, of course, opted in because nothing's going to hold me back. I'm going to go to this hike. It sounds amazing. And I ran out of all my lifesavers. So my blood sugar went really low. I went through all my sugar and somehow I got left behind with a 14-year-old counselor in training and the whole group moved on. And I completely passed out on the trail in the middle of the mountains. And the 14-year-old counselor in training was kind of marching up and down the trail trying to figure out what to do and fortunately didn't leave me. And at one point, a paramedic who was off duty out for a jog in the mountains happened upon us.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And said to the 14-year-old, you know, what's going on, this kid? And the 14-year-old said, she has diabetes. He said, stay with her, stay right here. I'm going to get out of here and come back with a glucagon shot and we'll take care of this.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And I, you know, it could have gone in a very different direction. So it reminded me of the mortality piece, but it also, that moment gave me a really strong sense of a higher power. Like there's no reason this person would have been jogging, a paramedic at that time. And I just felt very much in God's hands. And I try to be smart with the decisions I make in life and not take crazy risks. But it's also really comforting to know, like, I really do feel like God is with me and with me in the journey. I'm not alone. So that was a very powerful experience. I think the third piece I would just say about this, in high school, I got to the point where, you know, kids would start drinking, go to parties and kind of get more wild. And I just knew I couldn't do that. I couldn't with diabetes go and get drunk. Like that just wasn't an option. And I suddenly found myself feeling very much like an outsider. I had always been, you know, kind of in crowd, well-liked, athlete, did different things and suddenly felt like, oh, I can't do that anymore. I feel more like an outsider. And I started at that time working with kids with Down syndrome. It's when I started kind of paying more attention to, gosh, who are the students of color at our school? And what is their life like as minorities in this mostly, you know, white public high school? And it just kind of had the impact for me of thinking about, gosh, what are other people's experiences who feel left out of the kind of the norm of what's going on? And I think that's really what carried me into the interests in political movements and civil rights and how people connect with their context, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Thank you so much for sharing that. You described the students at Boys Hope Girls Hope, the scholars at Boys Hope Girls Hope and Collegians as curious. And I don't know. I have a hard time not calling you a curious person, especially that last story you just shared about your personal experiences of being kind of an outsider when social dynamics shifted in high school and how it made you start thinking, okay, well, this is how I feel. I wonder if others are feeling the same way. And then how can I get engaged and involved and learn more? That's a wonderful, another wonderful trait for us to have is curiosity. I think if you can connect your passions and your career with your curiosity, that could be really sustainable. I apologize. I kind of got choked up a little bit with the hike story. It's just a moving story. But yeah, I think God does have you. So this idea about mortality, you know, that's something I've been thinking a lot about because there's a lot of loss and This happened when Kobe Bryant died, and I really started kind of having these thoughts about what does this mean? And then we lost John Lewis. And then, of course, you know, we're always constantly losing people, and this pandemic has ramped that up. But at such a young age, at 6 years old, when you're diagnosed with diabetes and have this significant medical difficulties, this idea of at such a young age being forced to really grapple with this idea, it's a kind of a high level, kind of high order way of thinking. It really is. So for a 6-year-old mind to say, okay, this will end, you know, and so what can I do to make sure I maximize myself and fortify myself, but then also needing to find what my purpose is going to be and how can I help others and making sure that I make every moment count, that's a pretty big ask for a 6-year-old. And so, you know, I just maybe just for a few more comments, if you can just talk about that piece right there, about this idea of mortality and where you're at with that now.
Yeah, I mean, I think this whole process started for me at age 6, and it's sort of ongoing, right? So as with anything in life, it develops with time. I am very healthy and active, and I am doing work I love, and I think that is like the best medicine a person can have. I do feel like that fuels me. People will say, you must be exhausted, you work so much. No, I love my work. I love the people I work with, and so it's not exhausting. I wake up like excited to work. I'm also a mom. I have 2 boys who are 9 and 12. I love them. They and my husband give me a lot of energy and support. But it's funny, Josh, I'm very strong, and yet something will happen with my health. I told you the other day, my insulin pump broke. I live in Guatemala. We had to get a new insulin pump. And it can be kind of like hitting a wall again. Oh, yeah, you do have a significant health issue, and you do have to pay attention to that. And so it's kind of up and down. I have my moments where I feel really just bummed about my health or bummed about having to deal with this. But I usually get up the next day and it's like, let's go. Let's, as you said, let's maximize this time. Let's maximize this experience. And just another piece of that is I think life is about people and relationships. And I love the time I have, whether it's through my work or my personal life, just to connect with people and hear their stories and hear what's going on. That, in some sense, is even more important, I think, than whatever legacy we leave behind of the work done. Mm. It's kind of like the conversations had, the people we met, the people we connected with along the way is really extremely meaningful for me.
Well, I appreciate that. I think that's as good of a note to end it on as any. Kristen, so I promise that I want to make sure that people know how to find you or get a hold of you and Boys of Girls Hope or anything else. What's the best ways?
So our website gives people all kinds of ways to connect. As you said, www.boyshopegirlshope.org. And if anybody wants to email me as well, my last name is tricky, but KOSTBY at BHGH for boyshopegirlshope.org. I'm happy to get emails and connect with people that way too.
Well, thank you for your wonderful words. I appreciate you.
Josh, thanks so much for you. I love the opportunity to talk with you today, and thank you so much for bringing our incredible work to a broader audience. It's really exciting. Thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Thank you for listening to the Best Worst Thing podcast. I'm your host, Joshua Lewa. Music is produced by Josh One. You can follow him at Boom Note on Instagram and Twitter, and Josh One on Spotify. Our episodes are edited by Cool Jets Audio and Visual. You can follow them at Cool Jets AV on Instagram. Our marketing is designed by Francesca Daniels. You can find her at FrankandKitty24 on Instagram. And our overall design is by Inspired Design with Ryan Daniels. You can find them at getinspired.design on Instagram. Thank you for listening to the Best Worst Thing.
This one's for the good times, and this one's for the bad. This one's for the day that was the best we ever had. This one's for my good friends, and this one's for my foes. The ones who get up on your skin and do not even know.